What is up, guys? Welcome back to the show. We have got, I'm actually going to go through a guy's take episode today. I wanted to talk about the halving. I wanted to talk about the kind of the market sentiment around Bitcoin and why I really don't think the halving is priced in. And after going over Nick Carter's article and also Plan B's article, pushing back on the idea and really digging into the idea that the risk is simply overbought, I guess you could say, or overestimated, which it's done in the past. And I think that was a really good argument. I think he's really hit the bulk of what I wanted to get at, but I still think there's a lot more there to unpack. So I wanted to dedicate a whole episode to why I think the halving just is not priced in on Bitcoin. Now, I do want to say I'm apologize, I guess, for the lack of episodes recently. It's been a crazy week and weekend, a couple of funerals and burial and everything. So I've been really behind. Sorry for this being late, but I'm hoping I'll get back into the swing of things here. So with that, before we get into this, if you haven't listened to Nick Carter's piece on the efficient market hypothesis, that was two episodes back, and then the previous episode was Plan B's article on that and how it may relate to the stock-to-flow ratio, the stock-to-flow model, which is what we're breaking down. So if you haven't covered those yet, or you don't know the stock-to-flow model, I'll try to give a basic introduction, but I really don't want to spend too much time on it because we've hit it a number of times in the past. I'll have links to those episodes if you want to listen to them. But essentially, we've got the inflation rate is going to cut in half on Bitcoin. And so the supply schedule is, running its course, and we've got just a handful of months now until the next Bitcoin halving. And instead of 12.5 new Bitcoin every 10 minutes, we're going to cut that down to 6.25 Bitcoin. And that is a very significant supply shock. And I think the only way to start with this is just the basic supply and demand. And of course, stock to flow. So just for the idea of stock to flow is just how many Bitcoins exist versus how many new Bitcoins are being issued or entered into circulation. So the higher it is, that means the lower the inflation rate. And of course, in the not too distant future, Bitcoin is going to have an incredibly low inflation rate or an incredibly high stock to flow ratio. The efficient market hypothesis is essentially, I'll just actually quote Nick Carter here because he does a really good job of breaking it down. And again, I highly suggest the episode if you haven't listened to his article, An Introduction to the Efficient Market Hypothesis. But it's essentially that if there is a piece of known information that a free market, one without any huge barriers or any, government controls or inability to actually obtain the price, they will reflect that information. They will price in that information as long as price setting entities are willing and mechanically able to act upon it. That was kind of his caveat in the article, which I thought was a really great way to just kind of define it, because there are caveats to the efficient market hypothesis. Is there are, jurisdictional barriers, or there are geographical and cultural barriers and liquidity barriers, all of these things that prevent that equilibrium price from being found. Despite the fact that pressures will always be to account for that information in the market. And I think it's really important to understand where that comes from, is that it's people seeing an arbitrage opportunity across time. So that is what it means to price some information in that is in the future, is that you see a higher price in the future or a lower supply available in the future, and therefore you are trying to you're trying to take opportunity or take advantage of an opportunity for arbitrage across a 6 month or a 1 year time period. So the question or kind of the thought would be is, why aren't we taking advantage of that? Or why is that not being accounted for in the Bitcoin markets? Or is it, as Nick Carter says, that he believes the halving is priced in and that the supply, the change in supply is not important, or that it should not affect the price significantly, but that there are other things that would affect demand, and that clearly Nick Carter is very bullish on Bitcoin, but it's got nothing to do essentially with the supply because that is necessarily priced in. The information is widely known. It is freely available to anyone in the market. We have very high liquidity. The market has become very financialized since, 2016, 2017. There's really the explosion there. And then in the last 2 years, it's gotten even more financialized and available to large institutions. Arbitrage is basically non-existent. Nick and Plan B really break that down thoroughly as to how, like, essentially arbitrage across currencies and stuff is just not there. The connections or the flow across borders and jurisdictions is incredibly good. And so he did not see a specific reason why that information would not be priced in. If the EMH, if the efficient market hypothesis holds true, it seems to make sense that there is not much holding the market from pricing in the halving, which is right around the corner. So first, before we get into it, let's go back and hit supply and demand again. This is very basic, and it's really assumed in both the articles, but just in case. Supply and demand is a very simple curve. You know, you have the little chart, and you've just got the line of demand starting high and going low. You got the supply starting low and going high. And basically, the equilibrium price of the market, the price that the market wants to get to, is where the supply and the demand cross on that chart. And anytime when those things are out of balance, that's an arbitrage opportunity, right? And if you move, if you shift the supply or the demand, like if you should shift the supply lower, since it's an increasing line, well, then that means the new equilibrium price is higher if demand remains static. If everything else stays exactly the same, if you shift the supply down, if new supply is harder to obtain, well, then the price will go up, all other things held constant. So starting from that, starting from that known, we know that if demand stays constant and you cut the supply in half or the new supply in half, the price must adjust upward. All right. So now let's go back to the EMH statement, the clarification or the kind of extension of the EMH that Nick Carter uses, because I think this is really good, was that, quote, free markets reflect available information to the extent that price-setting entities are willing and mechanically able to act upon it, end quote. I want to start with willing. This is where I want to. So are they willing and able? Now, like I said, I think Plan B really hit it on the head, is that this is a situation where they're trying to price in risk. And it's important to remember, too, that everything is going to have a time discount. So capital today is going to be more expensive than capital in 6 months. Everything has a time cost to it. So even if we are trying to price in the next halving today, it is unlikely to price in completely, because essentially the amount of value and the amount of capital available is going to be less. Typically, it depends on, what kind of monetary system you're in. But if you just look at strictly resources, there's always going to be less today than there is in the future. And it is far more valuable to have capital today right at this moment than it is to be pretty sure that you're going to have it in a year, which is why there's a premium, which is why there's a 10% interest rate. That's why the interest rate exists. It's the relative cost of time for using up somebody's resources today versus waiting for a year. And that cost difference, which is not insignificant, is there to attempt to price in A, the time itself, but also the risk, no matter how small, that I might not get it in a year. And that could be because the institution that is involved, the person who's borrowed it, might collapse. Like I said, the institution might collapse. I might not be around in a year. I don't really know. I hope and plan, obviously, to be around in a year, but I don't know. So I could use those resources today and know that I got to use them. And there are a lot of unknowns and uncertainties in waiting for a year. And specifically in handing those resources over to somebody else and hoping that I'm going to get it back. That is why it costs money to borrow capital. The higher the uncertainty, the higher the interest rate, the higher that premium is on having to get it today versus in the future. I think the vast majority of why I think the halving is not priced in that right there, is in the fact that uncertainty is extremely high and very different for the Bitcoin market and for more specifically the price setters and the financialized institution, the large financial institutions that are finally getting involved in this space. I think for the major price setters and anything, literally anyone other than the hardcore Bitcoin enthusiasts, uncertainty is seen as incredibly an incredibly powerful force in this market, and pushes prices down essentially as far as they can go before they find equilibrium with supply and essentially a foundational demand. I think there is a profound amount of ignorance about what Bitcoin is, why it's here. Going back to the Nick Carter's EMH statement, is that are they willing to take this bet? Are they willing to actually price it based on what that future demand, what that future supply is going to be? And here's one really important thing too, is that there's, let's sort of just ignore, let's say that the time risk, that the time discount, quote unquote, or time premium, whatever you want to call it, for Bitcoin is actually just the same as it usually would be for everything else. Why aren't all the halvings priced in? I think this is a really important thing to consider if we're talking about how exactly the efficient market hypothesis, because no matter what, if we're going to reach, if there is an equilibrium price here, there is going to be time to finding that equilibrium price. It's not as if the information happens and it's just like 10 minutes later, it's like, boop, now we've got the new equilibrium price. There is a time to finding it, and there is a consistent and ever-present pressure back to the equilibrium price. That's mostly what it is a series of ever-changing pressures that never actually find a thing. There's like, you think about equilibrium price, there's not really any such thing because there's no such thing as static information. The state of the world is never static. So there is only ever a pressure in some direction that is likely toward the equilibrium price based on the EMH, based on this, you know, this theory. Which, by the way, if you haven't really dug into the ideas of prices and how they come about in a Hayek's piece, The Use of Knowledge in Society, is all about that. And I've got that as part one and part two. And I've read both of these on the show, so I'll try to remember to link to those as well. But this, I constantly recommend this on the show. I'm sure you've heard me, but if you haven't listened to it, you got to. It's such a critical piece of this whole puzzle as to what prices are and how markets, how they're used in a market, like what's their role in the market. So anyway, so back to that question, why aren't all of the halvings priced in, all the halvings? Phil Geiger from Unchained Capital wrote a really good article that I'm actually in the process of doing audio for like a couple of them, and his is one of them. But about how all 21 million coins exist already. And I think he's right. He makes a really good argument. And but just thinking about it on the surface is that everything about, you know, the scarcity of gold or diamonds or platinum, whatever it is, it's essentially guessed. It's theoretical scarcity. It's that based on our technology, this is roughly what we can find right now. But we don't really know. Somebody could stumble upon a very large cache of gold somewhere, you know, in a mountain or something that we just didn't know about, and increases the inflation rate at an entirely unexpected amount. And we don't know exactly how much is out there. We might find out that there's a lot more gold on this planet. We might find, you know, everybody talks about asteroid mining and some other planet or something. There's tons of gold out there in the universe. The question is, do we have the capacity to go get it? But because of that, we really don't have any clue what the supply and inflation rate of gold is. It just happens to be relatively stable because of the nature of gold itself. But that certainly doesn't mean that it will be. And Bitcoin is completely different. Bitcoin is completely different. Bitcoin could not be more perfectly known to the end of things. Like, to 2140, we know exactly how much, and we even can guess the dates that it's going to happen, that the supply schedule is going to change. So if we assume that just because the information is known, and just because you know, we can predict the time it's going to happen, that we can still somehow evaluate and know what that future price is going to be, then why wouldn't the 2024 halving already be here as well? Wouldn't the price have already adjusted? I think where we find the reasons that it has not adjusted to it is in a couple of things. First is just the amount of time it takes to mature something, and for essentially the market to be certain that these events are actually coming in the future. Again, back to risk. What's the amount of risk in holding it that long, in believing that that future is actually going to happen? What's the amount of certainty that we have, or uncertainty that we have, in holding it and having it today versus after the halving actually happens? Now, I think as time goes on, that confidence will go up, that degree of certainty will increase, and we will start to really lead the halvings. And I think I'm inclined to think we'll do it this time, just because there's so much conversation about it, and it's far more widely known today than it was in the previous. And as Nick Carter said, we have a far more financialized market. But what I think that means is that we will simply lead it a little bit, at least a lot more, actually, than we did last time. In fact, last time we didn't lead it at all. It was basically dragging behind the stock-to-flow ratio, in a sense. Or at least it was underneath what the stock-to-flow model would suggest was our new equilibrium price based on the inflation rate. So we'd actually see the price being pushed lower and then pulled up, essentially, with that thing. And I think we cannot discount. I think the basis of this is in trying to figure out why the stock-to-flow is accurate, because there is co-integration. The model is, I think, assuming just because it's convenient that this is a coincidence, or that it just is random, for as tightly as it actually follows that model, I do not think this should be outright discounted. I think it deserves a lot of attention, particularly when you're talking about the monetization of a new money, of a new good, essentially. But I think that so much of the reluctance to actually price Bitcoin based on future supply events is, even though there's a lot of other things I want to get into, I really think that Bitcoin is just outside the Overton window for most investors. For I think there are plenty of speculators that are there just to put money on something, but I think the mentality of the market around trying to understand the significance of Bitcoin scarcity and trying to understand what Bitcoin's utility, like why does Bitcoin even exist? It is a wholly new type of asset. It's not just like we found a new metal and we're trying to figure out if it's going to follow the stock to flow ratio. We found something that we have no other utility for other than the fact that it is scarce and can be owned. It is entirely digital. There is no, we have no reliable way to price this thing. We don't, evaluating this good, is it 100% unique in the history of markets? We don't have an easy way to do it. There are no price to earnings ratios. There's no price to book. There are no dividends to calculate. It is a simple matter. I don't even think most of the people who invest in it, who actually buy it as a speculative asset, can even explain properly why it would be valuable. So back to our basic supply and demand, is our caveat that the supply is going to increase the price is that the demand remains static. I don't think anybody has that. I think a tiny, tiny amount of the market actually has some degree of assurances that the demand will remain constant or increase. I think a lot of people, are in Peter Schiff's situation, is that this is a hype bubble. They might put money in it to play off of somebody else's hype, to, you know, buy the Ponzi scheme and be the one that got out before it all crashed. But I think a ton of people cannot explain to themselves why it would still be around in 6 months, why it would still be around in a year. I think the value proposition for Bitcoin, for a scarce digital thing, something that is completely made up in the digital world, is so outside of the norm, so outside of the Overton window of the typical investor, the people who have enormous amounts of money, it's simply they are unwilling to price in something like the supply change because they don't know if it matters. Essentially, the risk of whether or not anybody is going to care about it after that, I think, is seen as incredibly high. But let's say they do. Let's say we do have some huge institution that really sees Bitcoin as valuable and knows that it's going to be around. The industry is also brand new. Like Nick Carter says that, you know, past 2015 and 16, we were actually like financialized. But I think in the grand scheme of things, when we're talking about, so let's go back to the stock to flow model real quick. If the next halving follows the stock to flow model and really follows the idea of the supply being the determining factor of what an equilibrium price would be for this market, we're talking about trillions of dollars, multiple trillions of dollars. The amount of money that would require, I think putting that amount of money in a market that can say it's financialized, quote unquote, since like 2017, is something that is seen as crazy. At least I would think that that's how the general financial market would see it. This is an untested financialized industry. Even the institutions that are supposedly good, Fidelity Digital Assets, Bakkt is brand new. Bakkt is barely out the gate. And CME Futures, like these other institutions, they're not even holding Bitcoin. The purchasing of Bitcoin in like CME Futures or whatever, they're cash settled. So they're not actually buying Bitcoin. So yes, there's liquidity there to price in something like that. But what there isn't is the assurances that you're actually buying a Bitcoin. And the idea that you would put money into an institution that started in September, that's what I think is like September 20th something was Bakkt, which is actually one that is actually Bakkt, Bakkt by Bitcoin. And that if you were purchasing it with them, they are actually holding it, and that, you know, they're trying to have a consumer platform and all this stuff. I actually just read something just the other day about they're going to have like an app that's going to look more like PayPal or something like that. So really interesting. But, you know, they partnered with Starbucks and all that jazz. But the first couple of days, they were like a couple of Bitcoins worth of liquidity. They dip their toes in the water very slowly. They're incredibly cautious. And the entire, not only is the industry new, it has no, it is not matured at all. It is so, it is brand new. It is a baby out of the womb. And because of that, there's no trusted reputation. You know, like these huge institutions, when you're talking about moving trillions of dollars, you just don't do that by searching Google and seeing what came up with the highest Yelp rating. You use trusted institutions that you've had relationships with for decades or years that have been around since, you know, the one that has 1906 on, you know, their copyright day or whatever the heck it is. But I don't think anybody with that amount of money, with serious money like that, is going to just throw it at something simply because there's liquidity available, particularly something that is brand new. And even more so, do they have the ability to store it? Does the company that's got this new reputation and this brand new industry, do they have the ability to store it safely? Think about all of our vaults that have worked, all of the processes and everything, they don't necessarily apply to Bitcoin. Like, it's a very different mechanism. Again, all of this, the systems for electronic transfer and electronic ownership of goods in the financial markets are specifically secured by the ability to edit it later if something goes wrong. That industry does not know how to deal and is absolutely by no means ready for the security practices necessary to secure an append-only database, one that costs millions of dollars to attempt to reverse and is politically, or I guess you could say socially, or like by the protocol, practically an impossible task. This is not a call up customer service and reverse the transaction situation. So who do they trust with that sort of money? Do they trust themselves? I think it would be like as if a new metal came on the market, and again, we're trying to price it with stock to flow or something, or we're trying to figure out what it's useful for with, you know, a utility. We don't even know. The market, it hasn't even found what all of the utilities are for it. Is it even conductive? You know, like, does it work good in electronics? Does it work good in you know, structures of buildings and all of this stuff? Like, we have no idea what it's good for, really. We're just starting to scratch the surface. And at the same time, somehow, you can't protect this metal with all of the vaults and all of the infrastructure that we already have. We have to recreate it from scratch. Well, somebody is going to see buying that metal. If you can't put it in the vault you already have, now the cost of having that new metal is not just the price of the metal and the price of time. If you're, again, let's say we're pricing in, you know, the fact that the inflation rate is going to be, you know, lower later. They're trying to price that in. So not only is the price of time there, but the price of feeling like you probably have to redesign and construct an entirely new vault and security system in order to properly store it for yourself. And I feel like most people who are holding that amount of money are going to want to custody it themselves. I could be entirely wrong about that point. I don't really know the ins and outs. I've never looked at a balance sheet anywhere with $1 trillion on it, so I don't know what those institutions do. But regardless of whether or not they want to self-custody, I cannot imagine that they are fast and loose with where they put that sort of capital. And in addition, you look at this industry. There's an article on Bitcoin Magazine very recently. 2019 was the worst year for hacks we've ever had. Not for amount, actually, because of Mt. Gox and what is it, in 2018 it was like CoinCheck or something like that. I can't remember. Read it some time ago. It's actually still, I'll try to link to that one too. I'll try to remember to put that in. But it's just about all the hacks that have happened this year and the amount. But because of those two big ones, those amounts were so high that the amount this year was not the max. In fact, it was like half of what was in CoinCheck or something like that in 2018. However, the number of hacks, I think the reason the amounts as well weren't so high is just because exchanges have learned not to put so much freaking Bitcoin in their hot wallets. But hacks are not uncommon. They're not really getting better in the degree of or in the sense that exchanges, you can expect an exchange to just not get hacked. I still think the exact opposite is true, is that if you're holding money with an exchange, you should always think that the longer you have it there, that it doesn't get hacked, that you're right around the corner from being hacked. It is so common in the industry, and I think that's another part of the maturation process that is not there, and another part of why there's is the perception, whether true, this arguably, you gotta say this one is true, the perception that holding Bitcoin in any form or fashion is a giant risk. If we're dealing with people who are anywhere in the ballpark, in the same stadium as Peter Schiff on his degree of intelligence or competence in regards to how he stores his Bitcoin, we are in a really bad spot if we're trying to claim that that market is ready to price in the next halving, or is at least not considering that a risk. I would imagine that's a huge consideration, mostly because it's a consideration for me. And I know what I'm doing, and I know the risks. I'm not, I know how these institutions get hacked most of the time. I stay very up to date on it, which may or may not be a good thing for my perception of it. Because of that, like I know the risks, and it scares me. And I think the fear, so much of the fear comes from ignorance, from not feeling, or from feeling like you do not have a clue what's going on and you don't know the risk. And I think, which is why I think that risk would be overestimated. One of the risk of exchange hacks was listed in Plan B, where he thinks a risk is being overestimated. And I think that's a huge part. And I don't even know if it's easy to overestimate that. In fact, the hackers are actually getting better at it. They're getting more, particularly in the context of like Chainalysis and stuff, they're getting better at hiding their money. They're knowing not to be quite as stupid and where to move their money to. Still getting caught, and Chainalysis is still basically able to break most of the privacy measures. But nonetheless, if the hackers are evolving and the number of hacks are increasing, that risk isn't getting smaller with time to hold money with somebody else. Again, it makes it look like the only way to actually hold, $100 billion, $1 trillion securely in this asset, which is exactly what's needed to really price in all of these future halvings and the idea, the real true nature of the scarcity of Bitcoin, may just require making your own custom proprietary, held in a secret hardware wallet in a bunker vault. I think it looks more and more for an institution in that position that there isn't a safe place to hold that amount of money in it. And that even if I stand to make 200%, 300%, is it worth the possibility of losing it all? Not even because, the price crashed, but just because you might just lose it. I mean, yeah, there's the Plan B talks about in his article, the risk and return model is that the risk is only 80% and the return is 200%. Because of the historical price moves. But that's not the risk here. The risk really is 0% or 100%, excuse me. You're just going to lose everything because there are a lot of ways to lose Bitcoin that have nothing to do with the price crashing. All right. There's still a number of other points that I want to hit on the are these institutions willing? And then another couple I want to hit on whether or not they're able to price this in. But really quick, let's hit our sponsor. I gotta go get a drink of water, and we'll be right back. So there's something else at play here that I think is probably one of the key factors, A, to assessing the risk, and B, also trying to price in future events. So the cost of time and the cost of the risk associated with actually being involved in Bitcoin. So again, there's all the immaturity of the industry, the very, very new avenues that it's connected to the financialized institutions. In fact, actually, there was this one, what was that? I forgot about this. It was actually an episode of something that I listened to. It might have been Tales from the Crypt. Maybe it was the one with, I'm not going to remember the name. I'm going to see if I can find it again. But there was actually one with somebody who is part of these funds and moving enormous amounts of money around, and actually said something about hedge funds wanting, actually being interested in buying Bitcoin, but could not, for having any sort of a large stake in any significant amount of money in it, couldn't justify it to their investors. They felt it was too scary, or that even though they believed in it or something, that it was such a difficult sell to most of their investors that they didn't invest that money into it. And alternative assets, which I think Bitcoin would fall under, hedge funds will invest in commodities, bonds, a bunch of the very typical stuff. But then they do startups as well, even though that's riskier and not a huge portion of their, I think it's like something I read recently was like half of their money is in the traditional sort of bonds and things like that, the more safe haven assets. But then they do invest in alternative assets, and they do invest in more risky vehicles. Bitcoin being an example, I think, of not really a startup, not a small stock with a lot of potential, but an alternative asset, like buying a piece of artwork and, baseball cards or something like that, which, funds do actually do. But you got to justify that stuff. You have to justify that sort of thing to the investors. You have to know what you're doing. You have to be very knowledgeable in that. And again, I think this is specifically one of those cases in which there is such a huge lack of knowledge and lack of confidence in so many different ways, that Bitcoin does not fall under a safe alternative asset. It falls under a giant question mark of, is this stupid or not? But back to the idea I want to get at. Is that, so yeah, there's all the maturation, there's higher risk in holding it, et cetera, et cetera. But let's take a comparison of something that we know would adjust to the inflation. That if there was going to be a known supply shock in the not too distant future, why do we know that this asset would respond to it? What are the characteristics about the industry and about the asset itself that makes it obvious that the efficient market hypothesis, that the efficiency of the market would work incredibly quickly to price that in as soon as possible? And then ask, does Bitcoin have those characteristics? So let's look at gold. Let's say for some reason we know some giant mine that produces half of the gold reserves in the world. Let's say it's sitting under a volcano or something like that. We know in just a couple of months, this mine is going to be completely inaccessible and all the gold will essentially be irretrievable, and that this is literally half of the inflation schedule and we've got 2 months left to get as much out, and we just know we're going to miss like 90% of it, that there's just nothing we can do. Well, they're going to price that in, right? The market is absolutely going to adjust for the fact that, holy crap, in 2 months, this is going to be gone and the inflation schedule is going to be very different. So why do we know gold would do that? I think there's a handful of key reasons. One, gold's market. Nobody thinks the demand for gold is going to go anywhere. The demand for gold is not shaky. Even when it does subside at times, even when, when there's high uncertainty and confidence in the markets and gold isn't really used as a hedge much, it's always going to come back around. The gold has an incredibly established market presence. It's used for lots of other purposes. It's got utility and electronics and all these manufacturing purposes. And when the price actually falls, its use in all of those other areas goes up because it becomes more affordable to use gold, which is a better alternative in some of these cases for those utilities. So there is all of this confidence in the industry, and there's all this confidence in the other utilities and ways that gold can be used, and the fact that even if the demand does subside for some reason, it will come back. Therefore, the market's going to price in it very quickly. There's no question that gold is still going to be around in, you know, 6 months when the inflation rate is cut in half. Like, nobody's like, oh, what if the industry goes away? No, nobody's concerned about that. And what's the most important factor there, or at least in my perception, particularly in how it applies to Bitcoin? The Lindy effect. Gold has been around for thousands of years. It's not going anywhere. So the Lindy effect, we've covered it a number of times on the show, but I actually couldn't find a specific article about the Lindy effect. And there is one that I read, like Bitcoin Lindy and something something is the title. If anybody can remember it, please tweet it out to me, because I can't remember exactly what it was, but I don't have audio of it on the show. So I might actually just cover something about the Lindy effect. But basic idea, very simple. The longer something has been alive, the longer the sentiment is, or the mentality of the market and the participants are that it's going to continue to survive, that it is proportional to the amount of time it has existed for how much time it has left, how long it's going to be around. So like right now, the internet, if you're investing in something in the internet, or you're building something on, like, let's say you're a company and you're spending an enormous amount of money to build a large internet presence, well, you're not concerned that in 5 years the internet might not be around, because the internet has been around for like 30-ish years now in a huge capacity. So it's like we can easily expand out or extend out 30 years into the future and assume, yeah, the internet's pretty much going to be here. It's kind of considered a normal facet of reality now. This is the new normal. The internet exists and it's not going anywhere. That is the Lindy effect. Gold has an unbelievable Lindy effect. There is no Lindy effect like gold's Lindy effect. That is why the market is going to price that in. Not only that, but it has all of these other uses, and it has these other utilities, which actually make it a worse money, which is funny. Even though it gives it a better, I guess you could say, demand floor, it does actually make it worse as an economic measuring stick. And there's a really great piece by Connor Brown. Bitcoin has no intrinsic value, or doesn't have intrinsic value, and that's great, I think is what it's titled. Oh man, I've got so many links. I just keep pulling them out. Okay, I've got to start writing some of these down, or I'm going to forget all of this. I'll try to remember to link to that one in the show notes. That's a really good one. But how do we compare that to Bitcoin? What's Bitcoin's Lindy effect? So back to my original question, the question I actually started this off with is, why aren't all the halvings priced in? Because there is no market sentiment or pressure. The Lindy effect suggests there's no reason to think Bitcoin will be around for another three halvings. We've only been through two. This is number three. Bitcoin just turned 11 years old, and as far as its market presence, it's 9 years old. Really eight. Before that, it could have been killed. Before that, it was incredibly centralized. It was tiny. It was a baby still in the womb, just released into the wild, you know? And so the Lindy effect for Bitcoin is a powerful force, I think, for keeping the price down. Because if you're trying to plan for something that's 6 months out, it's a year out, that's 8 years out, and the thing that you are investing in is barely 8 years old, that's going to be seen, like, you might not price that in at all. That might have a price of zero today, regardless of what it means in the future. And, you know, cryptography has a shelf life, traditionally. Even SHA-256 has the possibility of being destroyed or being made obsolete by new technology, new methods, you know, new math that essentially, I mean, we could find out that it's actually, there's actually a way, quantum computers, you know, notwithstanding, but the assumptions of the hard problems of the, you know, one-way functions and the fact that some things are just incredibly hard to do might just be because we're humans and we're really incapable of doing things. And, you know, maybe a computer that's just made to iterate on one thing and learn from it and do it hundreds of trillions of times over a period of 5 years, figure something out that we never could just from the process of elimination, just from essentially an evolutionary process of code, figuring out that there's a way to break some cryptography. So this plays into the Lindy effect. This plays into the value of any perceived thing that's going to happen in the future, is that if it's only 6 months out, there's really a question as to whether or not this thing's going to be here in 6 months. If it's 10 years old, you know, 6 months is 1/20th of its life. You know, what degree of discount does that get for having to wait 6 months when there isn't an established market? And again, it's so outside the Overton window of what the typical investor and asset, there's not even a standard way to measure it. You know, there's no way to even value this thing. Why does anyone value it? I think it's so misunderstood that all of these things are exaggerated. So even though I think these risks and the Lindy effect and all of these things, the time cost, the uncertainty in the space, whether or not it gets the exchange or the institution that you're using gets hacked, whether or not you can even hold it, whether or not that amount of money can even rightfully be stored in it. I think all of these problems and risks are exaggerated because there's such a tiny amount of the market that even has a mental hold on why this thing should be valuable, why it has any demand outside of sheer, pure speculation right now. Now, we've read Parker Lewis's article on the show, which I think it's one of the Gradually Then Suddenly series, which we have the rest of that series coming very soon, but that Bitcoin is not backed by nothing. Another one I highly recommend if you haven't listened to. I highly recommend that whole series. It's fire. But Bitcoin is not backed by nothing. Breaks down how essentially what Bitcoin is backed by, its utility and its value is in its monetary properties. The adherence and assurances to its monetary policy that we get. And again, I don't think any of the normal investors, any of the normal financial industry price setters have any way to price that. They do not know how to evaluate the likelihood or the assurance of the monetary properties of this asset. And that is what it's backed by, which is why I think the actual real world supply commands more power than the information of the next halving. Is that when the supply actually gets cut in half, that is when the market responds to the fact that there is going to be less supply. But there's still a couple of more things I want to hit. I don't want to get to my conclusion too quickly. So what's the value of money? So if this thing is valued by its monetary properties and money is the tool that it's good for, what's money good for? So we read another one that I love and highly recommend by Hans Hermann Hoppe, The Yield from Money Held Reconsidered, and talks about holding money, or the very nature of having money, is as a hedge against uncertainty, against future uncertainty. And this is why I think Bitcoin does not yet fulfill the role of money, except for a tiny subset of people, myself being one of those, is that it only hedges uncertainty if you are more certain about Bitcoin than the uncertainty that you're afraid of. And that is where, like, someone in my position, like, when I've read all of this stuff and I've broken down all these arguments and I feel like I know, and I've really dug into the weeds of Bitcoin to see what it is, and then subsequently learned about the risks associated with the alternative, well, Bitcoin is money to me because it does exactly that. I'm hedging against uncertainty. I don't know what the hell's going to happen with the global financial system. Negative interest rates seem absolutely batshit insane to me, and it scares me to no end to have money locked up in that world. Bitcoin is relief for me, but I do not think that is how the majority of the market sees it. I think it's just the opposite, is that all of the normal mentality and all of the hedging against uncertainty is specifically in things that are not like Bitcoin, that are not these weird new assets and alternative investment vehicles. So I think the predominant reason Bitcoin has value is completely lost on the institutions that are supposed to be setting its price. I think the information of what makes Bitcoin valuable, the knowledge and understanding in the market, is not there. The confidence in it is not there. And again, there is no consensus on any sort of valuation method. The fact that we've had three episodes about the stock-to-flow ratio, I think, is just here, is some degree of proof of that. There's stock-to-flow is an incredibly contentious thing to talk about because so many people will think you're crazy and stupid for thinking just supply would have an effect on the price when everybody knows it's going to happen. And Nick Carter laid out his argument incredibly well, and I think he had a ton of amazing points. I think he's exactly right, too, on the nature of the efficient market hypothesis. I just think he discounts a lot of just how new and when just untested, just this thing is just not like all the others. It just isn't. And I don't think anyone sees it with that degree. I think the only people that are willing to throw their money at it and take the risks on the exchanges and do all this are speculators who are just trying to make a buck. And it's not people who understand what Bitcoin is really valuable for, and it's not demand that will stick around in the face of something very disastrous happening. I think those are the holders of last resort, and I think they do produce a price floor, and they play an incredibly important role, but it's not in pricing in future events. I don't think there's enough capital there to account for that. And of course, I don't think the mentality is there to properly assess what a change in the supply of something that somebody can't even explain why it's got valuable any value right now, why a change in supply or how a change in supply would affect it. And then basically after that, we've still got a whole crap ton of other risks that Plan B went into, is the Bitcoin might die, a huge software bug, or even some part of the structure just ends up not working in some sort of adversarial scenario. Just because we hadn't figured out how to kill it yet doesn't mean you can't. Again, this very much is in line with the Lindy effect and how I think people would assess, something that like this that is 10 years old and such new territory. How many people even in the world could properly review this system and explain whether or not it was secure? And how many people are going to put $1 trillion into something that can't get to that point, that you don't even know somebody personally that you trust that could tell you whether or not it was safe to put money in? But maybe it does survive. Maybe it is incredibly secure. Is it going to be legal when you hold it for 6 months, when you hold it for 2 years? What assurances do you have that even if you think it's the future, as a hedge fund, as an institution to buy something that's associated with drugs on the internet and terrorism, again, what a barrier to wondering whether or not it's safe to hold this thing for an event that isn't here yet. I mean, Trump tweeted about Bitcoin, and it wasn't exactly a nice tweet. Quote, "I am not a fan of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, which are not money and whose value is highly volatile and based on thin air. Unregulated crypto assets can facilitate unlawful behavior, including drug trade and other illegal activity," end quote. That is the President of the United States. If I am a hedge fund manager and I read that, that is not exactly a high degree of confidence for having a long-term investment in something that Donald off-the-hinge Trump is talking about in that language. But really, the one thing that threw me for a loop in Plan B's article for the risk was his little tweet. He did a poll asking what the biggest fear of investing is, or buying Bitcoin or something like that. I can't remember exactly what the question was, but the number one fear, which was something close to half, I think it was like 40% of the answers. I wish I'd actually saved this somewhere so I could have it right here, but that it was futures manipulation, was that you would be buying paper assets essentially that weren't backed by Bitcoin, that the price was being manipulated, and that even if Bitcoin's price pressure was going to go up, that the futures markets and the financial markets were going to essentially cheat and push it down. So they essentially are saying that they don't believe they're getting a fair price, that they're actually getting the market price. So again, willing and able. Is this a market that is willing and able to price in the future halving? And you know, even though I discount this, what about competition? What about competition? If literally scarcity is the only value that it has, what about Litecoin? Litecoin's even got all these other utilities. Remember, it's got cheaper transactions. Bcash has cheaper transactions. And all of this, like, if we don't have consensus on the valuation model, well, then it looks like we've got 1,000 Bitcoins to choose from. Again, why would the demand stay for this one when I've got this other one that's got shiny gadgets on it and it's got crypto kitties and all of these great things that Bitcoin doesn't have? Why on earth would the demand for Bitcoin stay consistent when the supply gets cut in half, or the new supply gets cut in half? But then that's not the case for this other one. And then, of course, if you just got here in Bitcoin, if you've only been here since 2017, you've never been through a halving. So if the reward schedule is essentially the security of Bitcoin, well, then what happens when the reward for securing Bitcoin gets cut in half? Is the halving something that's going to increase the value, or is it going to significantly decrease the value? Because yeah, there's less supply, but it seems like at the exact same time that you get less supply, don't you also get less security? Okay. So I think we've hit all these risks. I mean, there's obviously a bunch of other things that we could just come up with. And a lot of other specifications that we can talk about as far as risks of holding Bitcoin and the newness of the market. But so why would supply really be the thing to judge this by? Why would supply have such an effect on it if we are considering the co-integration and the correlation, the R squared or whatever it is, of stock to flow? If we are considering that it's so high because it is true, why would the supply really have that effect on it? And I think it's because it's so perfectly inelastic. The reason it's actually a good measurement or a good way to actually evaluate Bitcoin is because its monetary properties are its value. The combination of the scarcity of this asset over time with its survival is proof of that monetary policy, is those assurances, which means I think it is a derivative of time, which makes it incredibly difficult for to price that in first because of the Lindy effect. Because if it's not very old, well, then it needs to survive again and again, and its security model is going to change completely in about three or four halvings. So again, do we know it's going to be here? And then lastly, the demand is so up in the air. The demand is such an unknown, and it's so impossible to measure that in any other context. And maybe I'm just holding on to something because I'm super bullish, but it feels like it just makes sense to ignore that and look at the supply of the money. Scarcity is what makes this money, what makes this sound money. Scarcity is the key characteristic to all of this, is that we have a scarce digital asset in the digital world, in the virtual world. We've created scarcity. We've recreated scarcity. That is its utility. That is its value. That is why we believe it will continue to have value in the future. Because it's done something incredible that has never been possible before in the past, using an entirely novel economic structure, like game theoretic design, essentially. And I think finding the price of something like that is going to take an extraordinary amount of time. The market is not ready for it in 100 different ways. But what's funny is I agree with Nick Carter that I think the efficient market hypothesis is right, and I think his explanation of why it's not as simple, you know, it's not the hard version or the strong version of the efficient market hypothesis, but it's the one with those caveats. Are they willing and are they mechanically able to price this information in? I think that's absolutely right. I think he's just missing where they are not willing and where they are not, or how they are not mechanically able to price in the reality of the Bitcoin halving. So if Bitcoin had a 1,000-year established market with consistent demand, if there was no perception of competition, that it was obvious that Bitcoin was the winner and none of these other altcoins, thousands of altcoins, had any chance, it was clear that Bitcoin had no second place. That if it was unquestionable that Bitcoin was not going to die, if there was strong consensus on exactly how to evaluate this thing, and that the market wasn't just speculators, but it was people who knew and understand why Bitcoin had value and what Bitcoin was backed by, that if the liquidity and the industry, if not only the liquidity was there and not only the avenues were there, but if the industry was new, I mean, it was not new, it was old and tried and tested and had an incredible reputation, and none of these were new companies, and you know, we could use all the same hard tested, lasted for decades security measures on this asset, just like they did on all of the others, that if hacks were in steep decline and there was unbelievable regulatory certainty, that Trump came out talking about how great Bitcoin was and nobody on the, it was so embedded in the social psyche that obviously Bitcoin wasn't going anywhere, and the idea that it would be made illegal was just flat absurd, that if all that was true, yeah, the halving would be priced in. But because those things are in the way, because those things are risks and uncertainties in a good whose dominant role may very well be to hedge against uncertainty, judging by the stock to flow ratio may be the best thing we have for a little while. And, you know, in 8 years, I think that's going to change. If we go through this next halving and then the one after that, and the security model shifts over to predominantly fees, and we get a very different space. We get a much longer Lindy effect. We have companies that have now been around in the financial institutions for, you know, near a decade. I think after we cross a lot of market barriers and maturation process, then yeah, we will start pricing those things in. And I think this halving, I would bet that will lead it a little bit, and maybe the next halving will lead it a little bit more. And maybe it will break down as the market actually gets mature and we start to realize that, holy crap, in another three halvings, this thing's going to be a scarce effing asset. And they start just leading two halvings out. I think we are still very, very far from that reality. I still think we are, I think that is not this market. And that right now, the inflation schedule and the stock to flow may very well be the best pricing mechanism or the best valuation mechanism that we have. That the smartest way to measure whether or not to get into Bitcoin is the risk and return model, like Plan B said. So I guess we will close this here. This has been a guy's take episode, why I don't think the halving is priced in. And yeah, thank you guys so much for listening. I want to remind everybody today about BitBlock Boom. Gary Leland just recently tweeted out the whole lineup, and I will be speaking at BitBlock Boom, and I have a discount code. So if you haven't gotten your tickets yet for BitBlock Boom, that is in August. It's like towards the end of August. It's like 23rd or something like that. I will be speaking there. I would love to hang out with you guys. Use offer code CC, Crypto Economy, CC, and you will get a 30% discount, I think it is. It's a big discount. So if you haven't gotten your tickets, go ahead and do that now. Don't forget, I will be putting all of those links that I recommended and the other works that I recommended in the show notes. And if you can remember, if I forget to put one up there, remember you can go to thecryptoeconomy.com and just search for it and it will pop up. Pretty much everything is now on that website. There's still some tagging left to do, which is what mostly I did yesterday. So there's more to come. Don't forget to check out thecryptoeconomy.com and get your tickets for BitBlock Boom, offer code CC for that massive discount. All right, guys. Thank you so much for listening. I love you all. I am out. I'll catch you all tomorrow. Take it easy, guys.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.